Hello all and welcome back, and warm welcome from the far eastern corner of England over in Cornwall, where I'll be for the next 2 weeks. Thank you as ever, everyone, for getting in touch, sharing your thoughts and opinions. The best place to do so, comment section below, and if you have a longer story, maybe with some pictures, you can email hi@tuesdayatdobbs.com. I hugely appreciate all of the input, regardless of how insignificant you feel it is. It's all incredibly helpful for me to build up a picture of the general feeling around certain topics. And without all of your kind input, it'd be impossible to make these videos on a weekly basis. So I can't thank you all enough. Let's start this week. A film in waiting, surely. This is a continuation of last week. MZ Motorcycles, that... I was going to say that funny little East German brand, but it's nothing like that at all. This is a brand that often doesn't get the appreciation that it deserves for all it did for motorcycling. There are a lot of things that MZ Motorcycles did that helped steer motorcycling in the direction it went in. It was a very influential brand. Through all of the fascinating insight I read of your experiences riding MZs through the 70s, 80s, and 90s. There's one story that stood out for me. Here it is. Take a listen. Could be a film. From Super Smudge 59, Freddie, MZ's history. It's even more remarkable in the 1960s. Like many motorcycle companies, there was a genius behind their post-war rise. In this case, a development engineer called Walter Carden. It was Carden who understood how to get lots of power out of the two-stroke motor. And the 125 and 250 road races, or road race bikes, they developed from the late 1950s were highly competitive. Right up there with the likes of Honda and MV Agusta. And then, this is the bit, remember this name, then in 1962, their lead rider, Ernst Degner, defected from East Germany to Japan, taking all of MZ's knowledge of two-stroke tuning and passing it on to Suzuki and later Yamaha and Kawasaki. This was the reputation that MZ built up. They had just about as fine a reputation for building two-stroke engines as anyone had anywhere in the world. Meanwhile, MZ turned their attention in the 1960s to that grueling international six-day trial, and they won year in, year out. This shows how good they were between 1965 and 1970. Indeed, the single-cylinder 250 two-stroke motor developed for and used in the ISDT machines, well, that became the basis for the road machines produced from the 1960s through to the 1990s. There's no better training ground to prepare your motorcycle for just longevity than making it compete in the international six-day trials. Not only competing, but finishing and winning. These were seriously tough machines. But I knew that name. As soon as I read this comment from last week, Ernst Degner, that struck a chord with me because I remember someone telling me that name when I was out in Tenerife. And I just had a huge feeling of deja vu. There's a link between Ernst Degner and Tenerife. So I've done some digging. Born in 1931, Ernst Degner was a motorcycle Grand Prix racer from East Germany. Throughout the 1950s, he had a successful race career in East Germany, from which he was spotted by MZ. So MZ effectively headhunted him, saw this guy's got some talent, offered him a contract, not only as a racer, but also as an engineer. So Degner would come on board to MZ, race the motorcycles, and then go back to the mechanics, the engineers, and tell them how to fine-tune them, how to prepare them, how to make them even better, not just for racing, but for that to translate into the road motorbikes. This is from Wikipedia, and this bit really could be like a film. The Degner family's visits to attend races in the West forged friendships and relationships with Western riders. And soon the Degners, that's the whole family, saw for themselves the much improved lifestyles of their friends compared to their own. Furthermore, the Degners had no wish to bring up their children in a totalitarian state, obsessed with knowing everything that its citizens were thinking and doing. These thoughts encouraged the Degner family to consider escaping to the West, as many East German professionals were already doing. So the initial plan was to cross from East Germany. In fact, Not just that, cross from East Berlin into West Berlin and then fly from West Germany. The borders in Berlin allowed free passage of East Germans into West Berlin, where many then worked. The problem was, before such an escape could be implemented, the Berlin Wall was built in August 1961. God, that's a fascinating time in Germany's history. And the Berlin borders were then tightly sealed. So Degner then arranged, completely undeterred, he arranged for the escape of his family from the GDR, Eastern Germany, in a car trunk on the weekend of the 16th and 17th of September 1961, while he was actually racing at the Swedish Grand Prix. In 1961, Suzuki then hired Ernst Degner after he escaped, and Degner and all of his extensive setup and tuning knowledge from MZ, and he handed all of that to Suzuki. The problem is this: do you think the East Germans and MZ were going to just take this lying down? Not a chance. They explored every single legal avenue to make Degner pay for what he'd done, without success. But here's where things for me personally get even more fascinating, because of my link to Tenerife, one of my favorite places in the world. I spent a huge amount of time out there. In the early 1980s, Degner relocated to Arona in Tenerife, the little Spanish Canarian island. But in 1983, just a couple of years after he relocated, he died. This was the story I was given by a good couple of people in Tenerife. The general feeling within circles in Tenerife from people who remember that far back is that Degner was murdered by the East German Ministry for State Security, which I think is the Stasi, shortened. General feeling that, because they just couldn't accept what Degner had done. And years later, 20 years later, whatever it may be, they ended up murdering him in his home in Tenerife. Whether that's true, I don't know, but that's definitely a very strong rumour around his slightly untimely death, because I think he was only about 50 when he ended up dying. Will that be made into a film one day? I hope so. Moving on now, progress. Or I should say progress question mark. I'll start off with Susanna here to start this story. Freddie, picture included, I was delighted to hear you talk about the Yamaha SR250 last week. This pictured is Stan, my SR250 bought last year with the intention of using him to regain my confidence after a 7-year break from riding. Susanna, first of all, lovely looking bike. Welcome back to biking. Perfect bike to get back into it. But this got me thinking. I was thinking this, and then three other different conversations started with exactly my train of thought. And here's how it goes. William left a comment. The Yamaha SR250, about a 45-year-old bike, but it still has more horsepower than the new Honda GB350S. Progression? Stephen continues, well, that's going to be because of cleaner emissions, and that always adds on to the cost. So I thought I'd have a little fun here. Take a look at Susanna's SR250 pictured here, and now I'm going to put up pictured here the brand new, and I'm a huge fan of this, I've never ridden it, I think it looks excellent. This will be a colossal seller. It's the brand new Honda GB350. Take a listen to these specs of motorcycles, really separated by, should have written it down exactly, it's about 45 years or something like that. I'll start with the Yamaha, and I'm going to actually write these specs so you can see them while I read it out. The Yamaha is 130 kilo wet weight. That is microscopic. It's got 21 horsepower, and owners seem to regularly claim it gets, on average, 93 miles per gallon. Take a look at now the Honda GB. 300cc, of course, compared to Yamaha's 250. But it's 178 kilos. That's 48 kilos more than the Yamaha. 48 kilos is a colossal, colossal amount of weight. If you put them side by side, probably the Honda doesn't look massively bigger. But that is a wild amount of extra weight. Interestingly, the Honda has a claimed economy figure of 94 mpg. So it is almost, it's almost uncanny. To the mile, it's almost got exactly the same fuel economy figures as that 45-year-old Yamaha. This is what I really wanted to highlight when looking at those two. For one, just how similar they are. I'm not a speed freak, so I am not looking for motorcycles to be faster with every generation. I don't care about that. All I want is something to maintain the character, still look good, and just be reliable. That's all I really care about. But those figures, certainly just the basic figures on paper, when I look at it, first off, it tells me one thing. For one, economy. That's something surely that we could look at and think, look, even for me, I don't need more power, but yeah, why not? I would love more economy. But it shows that economy figures really haven't improved at all over the decades. Not at all. And that leads me to figuring out in my mind, why is that? Well, it's quite clear. It's weight. Because not just for motorbikes, but cars as well. There are so many electronics to make engines cleverer, to make the vehicles safer, that adds so much weight on, that all of that added engine intelligence, it's just null and void. Because it's added so much weight on, it adds no extra benefit to the economy of the vehicle, which is far, far lighter from 40 years ago. So lightness is everything. In a very roundabout way, I just looked at that and thought, look, you can't cheat lightness, whether it's a car or motorbike. If you want economy, if you want to save the world, forget about building big, heavy vehicles, cars or bikes. Just make something simple and ridiculously light. Also, when I see that 130 kilo of the Yamaha, can you imagine how fun that would be? 130 kilo bike. On now to Doug. Oh, more German stuff here. This is so interesting. From Doug, this is very simple. All Doug wrote is Triumph motorcycles started in Germany. I initially looked at that and I thought, Doug, what are you talking about? Triumph is the most British company there is. But I didn't have to do any digging at all to find out that I was quite naive and delusional. It's true. Siegfried Bettmann, born 1863, a German gentleman who relocated to Coventry, England in 1885. So around about the age of 20 years old or so, this German gentleman relocated. Just 1 year after Siegfried relocated to England in 1886, I should say, he established Triumph. And that was initially a company established selling bicycles. Fast forward a few years, and then in 1902, Bettmann moved Triumph into engine-powered bicycles, i.e. motorcycles. Everything was going well. World War I came around, and Triumph actually ended up supplying a huge amount of motorcycles for the war efforts. This is the funny thing. Siegfried Bettmann, a German gentleman living in Coventry, supplying colossal amounts of Triumph motorcycles for the war effort against the Germans. In fact, Siegfried had such a strong reputation, so much respect in Coventry, that in 1913, he ended up being the mayor of Coventry. And as all of the influence that Triumph had, giving bikes for the war effort, Triumph ended up, by the end of the war, being Britain's largest motorcycle manufacturer. But how do you think it was for a German gentleman with a highly successful company, helping hugely with the war efforts, and also the mayor of Coventry? How do you think that went down in the local area? Well, unfortunately for Siegfried, his mayoral duties were stripped of him. His position as the mayor of Coventry was taken away specifically because of the fact that he was German. But there you have it, Triumph Motorcycles. It was properly started by a German. I had no idea. That's fascinating. In fact, it ended up that you could argue that Siegfried was a bit of a war hero for the input he had on supplying all of those motorcycles. Apparently, Siegfried got the Triumph factory working around the clock, non-stop, to churn out these Triumph bikes for the soldiers in World War I. On now to Denzel. Oh, there's so many interesting stories. I could barely keep up this week. This one is equally as fascinating. Freddie, I moved to Bulgaria when I retired, and I gave up riding due to my age. But I accidentally came across a guy who owns a property near me and speaks English and is also a motorcycle enthusiast. So I met up with him again at a spa hotel in a town up in the mountains in Bulgaria, and he invited me around to see his collection of motorbikes. And so I went. He knew I knew a bit about bikes and that I was as enthusiastic as he was. In his shed was an ABC motorbike that I had never heard of and lots of other stuff. But his favorite bike was a Triumph T120 Bonneville, tucked away in this shed in the Bulgarian mountains, previously owned by Steve McQueen. Still in lovely condition and still ridden now and again, but just around town. He had authentication pictures and other bits proving all was legit. It was genuinely and is genuinely Steve McQueen's old bike. What a surprise. It's amazing what some people have tucked away in their sheds. Denzel, I really mean this. Please, this is a genuine plea, if you're willing to do so. If you ever see that Bulgarian gentleman again and you find out that he'd be willing to do a video there, I would ride my Triumph Bonneville from England over to the Bulgarian mountains to do a video dedicated to that bike and its story. I would love that so much. I mean, it would be fascinating to know where that bike came from, what the story was. But I've read numerous accounts of Steve McQueen, for example, when he was filming The Great Escape in Europe. And after filming or at any time off, McQueen became famous for behaving very badly, going around to local villages and towns and just buying old cars and motorbikes, racing them around the local countryside, sometimes crashing them, sometimes just leaving them somewhere, sometimes selling them at the end of shooting. And I wonder if this Bonneville T120 that I think started production in 1959 or so, I wonder if this could be one of the motorbikes that he just bought while filming one of his films in Europe, enjoyed it for 6 months while filming, for example, and then just ended up selling it to a local, and somehow it's ended up here in the Bulgarian mountains. And the fact the owner's got pictures substantiating the fact that it's McQueen's old bike. Denzel, thank you for sharing that. That's brilliant. Bike of the week. This is a rare one, but I've found one. This is from Petrus. Freddie, built only for the Canadian and US market. I'll see if you can guess this while I read it out before giving away the model of the bike. Built only for the Canadian and US market. A strong 750cc engine, carburetors, shaft drive, and disc brakes all around, far ahead of its era. I've picked one up, one of these bikes, by online auction, and I paid £850 for it. It's nothing at all. Cleaned it, made some adjustments, and it fired straight away. I had to register it in the UK as it was an import. The bike had been sympathetically restored, focusing on the engine, and it's now in superb condition. Pictures included, could you guess just from the picture? 1982 Kawasaki KZ750 Spectre. It's that Spectre bit at the end which is the key to what this bike is. Let's have a look at this. First of all, the thing that threw me. A bike from Kawasaki made for the American and Canadian markets. And it's, I'm sure about this, it's spelt Spectre in the English way, not the American way. I'm sure Americans spell it E-R at the end, not R-E. So that's the first slight quirk about this. Take a listen to everything I've found. Rider magazine said this about the Spectre. At a strip, without a police car around the corner, you can tell these are American reviews here. At a strip without a police car around the corner, a good rider could exceed 100 miles an hour in 12.5 seconds. This is why it had the GPZ engine, to impress the wheelie guys. Talk of the town was the Spectre, but unfortunately, it appeared just as our economy descended into serious recession. By the end of 1982, more than 10% of American workers were unemployed. To give a more motorcycle view of what was happening at that time, in 1980, Kawasaki had 30 different models on the showroom floor. In 1984, there were less than 12. So this is why, if we look at the Spectre, it was made only from 1982 to 1983, to the best of my knowledge. This Japanese bike aimed at the US market to try and get something from this custom scene exploding at the time in the United States. This was made for the market over North America, but made and sold just for 2 years. It had just a two-year lifespan, and this isn't some wild exotica. This was meant to be a fairly mainstream bike with such a short production run. But again, this article explains exactly why it just came at completely the wrong time in America when it was going through some pretty bad difficulties. This is even more interesting. I found a Cycle World magazine review of the bike in 1982, the year this bike was launched. They said, "The nice touches and extra horsepower and shaft drive add up to an appealing motorcycle for the rider who wants cruiser styling." That was the key to this bike. That cruiser element of styling that was meant to appeal more to the US market that Kawasaki just didn't think would quite work and have the same appeal, for example, for the European market. The bike works well, so well that it endeared itself even to staff members who usually prefer race bike styling. I almost gave up on this. I read all of this, I was extremely excited to find one of these bikes, but I didn't realize how rare these were actually. It wasn't my plan specifically to do a bike of the week that was another unicorn. I promise it wasn't my plan, but it just ended up being like this. They were made for 2 years, only for North America, and they are obscenely rare. I looked all over in the US. I couldn't find any, not one. Nothing at all. The only place I managed to find one of these bikes was an extremely strange website called Jordan River Canadian Listed that looks like it's a website from about 2004. But on this website, this does look legit. There is one Kawasaki KZ750 Spectre in Jordan River, British Columbia, for sale. And it's just $1,500. I'll just read the listing. 1982, so the first year, Kawasaki Spectre. Great bike, but bought something newer. I'd love to keep it as well, but I just can't. Has new fork seals, yada, yada, yada. This bike has adjustable front and rear air suspension and is super comfy to ride. It sat for a year in a heated shop and it will fire up with no problems. Come take a look. I'm sure the owner knows just how rare these are, but Petros will back this up here. Petros paid 850 quid for his. This one's going for $1,500 Canadian. Even though these are so insanely rare, they're still not worth anything at all. It's the funny world of biking that we live in. Thank you so much, everyone, for watching this week's episode. I really hope you enjoyed it. See you in the next week.